which was incidentally where the Soviet carrier Kuznetsov had been built. The captain's additional problem was that his battlegroup commander, an admiral, had taken the chance to fly into Naples for a conference with the commander of the United States 6th Fleet. Richards was on his own. "Where's our friend?" Roosevelt's CO asked. "About 250 miles back," the operations officer said. "Close." "Let's get the plus fives right up, Skipper," Jackson said. "I'll take two in orbit right about here to watch the back door." He tapped the chart. "Play it cool, Rob." "No sweat, Ernie." Jackson walked to a phone. "Who's up?" he asked the VF-1 ready room. "Good." Jackson went off to get his flight suit and helmet. "Gentlemen," Richard said as Jackson left, "since we are now east of Malta, we are now part of the PSYOP, therefore a strategic and not a conventional asset, and DEFCON 2 applies to us. If anyone here needs a refresher on the DEFCON 2 rules of engagement, you'd better do it fast. Anything that might be construed as a threat to us may be engaged and destroyed on my authority as battlegroup commander. Questions?"
"Sir, we don't know what is happening," the ops officer pointed out.
"Yeah. We'll try to think first, but people, let's get our collective act together. Something bad is happening, and we're at DEFCON 2. It was a fine, clear night on the flight deck. Jackson briefed Commander Sanchez and their respective RIOs, then the plane captains for the two Tomcats sitting on the Wastecats walked the flight crews out to them. Jackson and Walters got aboard. The plane captain helped strap both in, then disappeared downward and removed the ladder. Captain Jackson ran through the startup sequence, watching his engine instruments come into normal idle. The F-14D was currently armed with 4 radar-homing Phoenix missiles and 4 infrared sidewinders.
"Ready back there, Shredder?" Jackson asked.
"Let's do it, Spade," Walter replied.
Robbie pushed his throttles to the stops, then jerked them around the detente and into afterburner, and signaled his readiness to the catapult officer, who looked down the deck to make sure it was clear. The officer fired off a salute to the aircraft. Jackson blinked his flying lights in reply, dropping his hand to the stick and pulling his head back against the rest. A second later, the cat officer's lighted wand touched the deck. A petty officer hit the firing button, and steam jetted into the catapult machinery. For all his years at this business, his senses never quite seemed to be fast enough. The acceleration of the catapult nearly jerked his eyeballs around inside their sockets. The dim glow lights of the deck vanished behind him. The back of the aircraft settled, and they were off. Jackson made sure he was actually flying before taking the aircraft out of burner. Then he retracted his gear and flaps and started a slow climb to altitude. He was just through 1,000 feet when Bud Sanchez and Lobo Alexander pulled alongside.
"There go the radars," Shredder said, taking note of his instruments. The entire TR battle group shut down every emission in a matter of seconds. Now no noise would be able to track them from their own electronic noise. Jackson settled down. Whatever this was, he told himself, it couldn't be all that bad, could it? It was a beautifully clear night, and the higher he got, the clearer it became through the panoramic canopy of his fighter. The stars were discrete pinpricks of light, and their twinkling ceased almost entirely as they reached 30,000 feet. He could see the distant strobes of commercial aircraft and the coastlines of 6 countries. A night like this, he thought, could make a poet of a peasant. It was from moments like these that he'd become a pilot. He turned west with Sanchez on his wing. There were some clouds that way, he realized at once. He couldn't see all that many stars.
"Okay," Jackson ordered. "Let's get a quick picture." The radar intercept officer activated his systems. The F-14D had just been fitted with a new Hughes-built radar called an LPI for low probability of intercept. Though using less power than the AWG-9 system it had replaced, the LPI combined greater sensitivity with a far lower chance of being picked up by another aircraft's threat receiver. It also had vastly improved look-down performance.
"There they are," Walters reported. "Nice circular formation."
"They have anything up?"
"Everything I see has a transponder on."
"Okay.
We'll be on station in another few minutes.
50 miles behind them, an E-2C Hawkeye airborne early warning bird was coming off the number 2 catapult. Behind it, two KA-6 tankers were firing up, along with more fighters. The tankers would soon arrive at Jackson Station to top off his fuel tanks, enabling the CAG to stay aloft for 4 more hours. The E-2C was the most important. It climbed out at full military power, turning south to take station 50 miles from its mothership. As soon as it reached 25,000, its surveillance radar switched on, and the onboard crew of 3 operators began cataloging their contacts. Their data was sent by digital link back to the carrier and also to the group air warfare officer aboard the Aegis cruiser, USS Thomas Gates, whose call sign was Stetson.
Nothing much, Skipper.
Okay, we're on station. Let's orbit and searchlight around. Jackson turned his aircraft into a shallow right turn, with Sanchez in close formation. The Hawkeye spotted them first. They were almost directly under Jackson and his 2 Tomcats, and out of the detection cone of their radars for the moment.
Stetson, this is Falcon 2. We have 4 bogies on the deck, bearing 281, 100 miles out.
The reference was for TR's position.
IFF?
Negative. Their speed is 400, altitude 700, course 135.
Amplify, the AWO said.
They're in a loose finger 4, Stetson, the Hawkeye controller said. Estimate we have tactical fighters here.
I got something, Shredder reported to Jackson a moment later. On the deck. Looks like 4 aircraft, heading southeast.
Whose?
Not ours.
In TR's Combat Information Center, no one as yet had a clue what was going on. But the group intelligence staff was doing its best to find out. What they had learned to this point was that most satellite news channels seemed to be down, though all military satellite links were up and running. A further electronic sweep of the satellite spectrum showed that a lot of video circuits were unaccountably inactive, as were the satellite phone links. So addicted were the communications people to the high-tech channels that it required the services of a third-class radio man to suggest sweeping shortwave bands. The first they found was BBC. The news flash was recorded and raced into CIC. The voice spoke with the quiet assurance that the British Broadcasting Corporation was known for.
Reuters reports a nuclear detonation in the central United States. The Denver, Colorado,
the Brits have trouble pronouncing some American state names,
television station KOLD broadcast via satellite a picture of a mushroom cloud over Denver, along with a voice report of a massive explosion. Station KOLD is now off the air, and attempts to reach Denver by telephone have not yet been successful. There has as yet been no official comment whatever on this incident.
Holy Christ, someone said for all of them.
Captain Richards looked around the room at his staff.
Well, now we know why we're at DEFCON 2. Let's get some more fighters up. F-18's forward of us, 14's aft. I want 4 A-6s loaded with B-61s and briefed on PSYOP targets. 1 squadron of 18s loaded with anti-ship missiles, and start planning an alpha strike on the Kuznetsov battlegroup.
Captain, a talker called. Falcon reports 4 inbound tactical aircraft.
Richards had only to turn around to see the main tactical display, a radar scope fully 3 feet across. The 4 new contacts showed up as inverted V-shapes with course vectors. Closest point of approach was less than 20 miles, easily within range of air-to-surface missiles.
Have Spade ID those bandits right now!
Close and identify, was the order from the Hawkeye control aircraft.
Roger, Jackson acknowledged.
Bud, go loose.
Roger.
Commander Sanchez eased his stick to the left to open the distance between his fighter and Jackson's. Called the Loose Deuce, the formation enabled the aircraft to be mutually supporting and also impossible to attack simultaneously. As he split off, both aircraft tipped down and dove at full dry power. In a few seconds, they were through Mach 1.
Bore sighted, Shredder told his driver. I'm activating the TV system. The Tomcat was built with a simple identification device. It was a television camera with a 10-power telescopic lens that worked equally well in daylight and darkness. Lieutenant Walters was able to slave the TV into the radar system, and in a few seconds he had four dots that grew rapidly as the Tomcats overtook them. Twin rudder configuration. Falcon, this is Spade. Inform Stick we have visual but no ID, and we are closing. Major Pyotr Arabov was no tenser than usual. An instructor pilot, he was teaching three Libyans the intricacies of night over water navigation. They had turned over the Italian island of Pantelleria 30 minutes earlier and were now inbound for Tripoli and home. Formation flying at night was difficult for the three Libyans, though each had over 300 hours in type, and overwater flying was the most dangerous of all. Fortunately, they had picked a good night for it. The star-filled sky gave them a good horizon reference. Better to learn the easy way first, Arabov thought, and at this altitude. A true tactical profile, at 100 meters and higher speed on a cloudy night, could be exceedingly dangerous. He was not any more impressed with the airmanship of these Libyans than the U.S. Navy had been on several occasions, but they did seem willing to learn, and that was something. Besides, their oil-rich country, having learned its own lessons from the Iraqis, had decided that if it were to have an air force at all, it had better have a properly trained one. That meant the Soviet Union could sell a lot more of its MiG-29s, despite the fact that sales in the Israel area were now severely curtailed. It also meant that Major Arabov was being paid partly in hard currency. The instructor pilot looked left and right to see that the formation was, well, not exactly tight, but close enough. The aircraft were behaving sluggishly, with two fuel tanks under each wing. Each fuel tank had stabilizing fins, and looked rather like bombs, actually. They're carrying something, Skipper. MiG-29s for sure. Right. Jackson checked the display himself, then keyed his radio. Stick, this is Spade, over. Go ahead. The digital radio circuit allowed Jackson to recognize Captain Richards' voice. Stick, we have ID on the bogies. 4 MiG-29ers. They appear to have underwing cargo. Course, speed, and altitude unchanged. There was a brief pause. Splash the bandits. Jackson's head snapped up. Say again, Stick. Spade, this is Stick. Splash the bandits. Acknowledge. He called them bandits, Jackson thought. And he knows more than I do. Roger. Engaging now. Out. Jackson keyed his radio again. Bud, follow me in. Shit, Shredder observed. Recommend we target 2 Phoenix, left pair and right pair. Do it, Jackson replied, setting the weapons switch on the top of his stick to the AIM 54 setting. Lieutenant Walters programmed the missiles to keep their radars quiet until they were merely a mile out. Ready. Range is 16,000. Birds are in acquisition. Jackson's heads-up display showed the correct symbology. A beeping tone in his headset told him that the first missile was ready to fire. He squeezed the trigger once, waited a second, then squeezed again. Shit, Michael Lobo Alexander observed, half a mile away. You know better than that. Sanchez snarled back at him. Sky is clear. I don't see anything else around us. Jackson closed his eyes to save as much of his vision as possible from the yellow-white exhaust flames of the missiles. They rapidly pulled away, accelerating to over 3,000 miles per hour, almost a mile per second. Jackson watched them home in as he positioned his aircraft for another shot if the Phoenixes failed to function properly. Arabov made another instrument check. There was nothing unusual. His threat receivers showed only air search radars, though one reading had disappeared a few minutes earlier. Other than that, this was an exceedingly routine training mission, proceeding straight and level on a direct course toward a fixed point. His threat receivers had not detected the LPI radar, which had been tracking him and his flight of 4 over the past 5 minutes. It was able, however, to detect the powerful homing radar in a Phoenix missile. A bright red warning light flashed on, and a screeching sound abused his hearing. Arabov looked down to check his instruments. They seemed to be functioning, but this wasn't... His next move was to turn his head. He just had time to see a half-moon of yellow light and a ghostly, starlit smoke trail, then a flash. The Phoenix targeted on the right-hand pair exploded just a few feet from them. The 135-pound warhead filled their air with high-speed fragments which shredded both MiGs. The same happened to the left-hand pair. The air was filled with an incandescent cloud of exploding jet fuel and airplane parts. Three pilots were killed directly by the explosion. Arabov was rocketed out of the disintegrating fighter by his ejection seat, whose parachute opened a scant 200 feet over the water. Already unconscious from the unexpected shock of ejection, the Russian major was saved by systems that anticipated his injuries. An inflatable collar held his head above water, a UHF radio began screaming for the nearest rescue helicopter, and a powerful blue-white strobe light started flashing in the darkness. Around him were a few thin patches of burning fuel, and nothing else. Jackson watched the entire process. He'd probably set an all-time one-shot record. 4 aircraft on 1 missile salvo. But there had been no skill involved. As with his Iraqi victim, they hadn't known he was there. Any new nugget right out of the rag could have done this. It was murder, not war. What war? He asked. Was there a war? And he didn't even know why. Splash 4 MiGs, he said over the radio. Stick, this is Spade. Splash 4. Returning to Cap Station. We need some gas. Roger, Spade. Tankers are overhead now. We copy. You splashed 4. Spade? What the fuck is going on? Lieutenant Walters asked. I wish I knew, Shredder. Did I just fire the first shot in a war? What war? Despite his earlier screaming, the Guards tank regiment was about as sharp a Russian unit as Keitel had ever seen. Their T-80 main battle tanks looked slightly toy-like with their reactive armor panels festooned on turret and hull, but they were also low-slung, dangerous-looking vehicles whose enormously long 125-millimeter guns left no doubt as to their identity and purpose. The supposed inspection team was moving about in groups of 3. Keitel had the most dangerous mission, as he was with the regimental commander. Keitel, Colonel Ivanenko, checked his watch as he walked behind the real colonel. Just 200 meters away, Gunter Bach and 2 other ex-Stasi officers approached a tank crew. They were boarding their vehicle as the officers approached. Stop, one ordered. Yes, Colonel, the junior sergeant who commanded the tank replied. Step down. We are going to inspect your vehicle. The commander, gunner, and driver assembled in front of their vehicle while the other crews boarded theirs. Bach waited for the neighboring tanks to button up, then shot all 3 Russians with his silenced automatic. The 3 bodies were tossed under the tank. Bach took the gunner's seat and looked around for the controls he'd been briefed on. Not 1,200 meters away, parked at right angles to his tank, were over 50 American M1A1 tanks whose crews were also boarding their vehicles. Power coming on, the driver reported over the intercom. The diesel engine roared to life, along with all the others. Bach flipped the loading switch to armor-piercing, fin-stabilized, discarding sabot round, and punched the load button. Automatically, the breech to the tank's main gun dropped open, and first the shell, then the propellant charge were rammed home, and the breech shut by itself. That, Bach thought, was easy enough. Next, he depressed the gun sight and selected an American tank. It was easy to spot. The American tank park was lit up like any parking lot so that trespassers might easily be spotted. The laser gave him a range display, and Bach elevated the gun to the proper steadimeter line. The wind he estimated as 0. It was a calm night. Bach checked his watch and waited for the sweep hand to reach the 12. Then he squeezed the triggers. Bach's T-80 rocked backwards along with 3 others. 2/3 of a second later, the shell struck the turret of the American tank. The results were impressive. He'd struck the ammo compartment in the rear of the turret. The 40 rounds of ammunition ignited at once. Blowout panels vented most of it straight up, but the protective fire doors inside the vehicle had already been blown out by the shell, and the crew incinerated in their seats as their $2 million tank turned into a mottled green and brown volcano, along with two others. 100 meters to the north, the regimental commander froze in mid-sentence, turning toward the noise in disbelief. "What's going on?" he managed to shout, before Keitel shot him in the back of the head. Bach had already fired his second round into the engine box of another tank and was loading a third. 7 M1A1s were burning before the first American gunner got a round loaded. The huge turret swung around while tank commanders screamed orders at their drivers and gunners. Bach saw the operating turret and swung toward it. His round missed wide to the left, but struck another Abrams behind the first. The American shot also missed high because the gunner was excited. His second round was instantly loaded, and the American exploded a T-80 two down from Bach's. Gunter decided to leave this American alone.
"We're under attack. Commence firing! Commence firing!"
the Soviet tank commanders screamed into their own command circuits. Keitel ran to the command vehicle.
"I am Colonel Ivanenko. Your commander is dead. Get moving. Take those crazy bastards out while we still have a regiment left."
The operations officer hesitated, having not the slightest idea what was happening, only able to hear the gunfire. But the orders came from a colonel. He lifted his radio, dialed up the battalion command circuit, and relayed the instruction. There was the expected moment's hesitation. At least 10 American tanks were now burning, but 4 were shooting back. Then the entire Soviet line opened fire, and 3 of the active American tanks were blown apart. Those shielded by the front row began firing off smoke and maneuvering, mainly backwards, as the Soviet tanks started to roll. Keitel watched in admiration as the Soviet T-80s moved out. 7 of them remained still, of which 4 were burning. 2 more blew up before they crossed the line where once a wall had stood. It was worth it, Keitel thought, just for this moment. Whatever Gunter had in mind, it was worth it to see the Russians and Americans killing each other. Admiral Joshua Painter arrived at Sinkland headquarters just in time to catch the dispatch from Theodore Roosevelt.
"Who's in command there?"
"Sir, the battle group commander flew into Naples. Senior officer in the group is Captain Richards," Fleet Intelligence replied. "He said he had 4 MiGs inbound and armed, and since we're at DEFCON 2, he splashed them as a potential threat to the group."
"Whose MiGs?"
"Could be from the Kuznetsov group, sir."
"Wait a minute. You said DEFCON 2?
TR's east of Malta now, sir. PSYOP applies, Fleet Operations pointed out.
"Does anybody know what's going on?"
"I sure as hell don't," the Fleet Intelligence officer replied honestly.
"Get me Richards on a voice line."
Painter stopped.
"What's the fleet status?"
"Everything alongside has orders to prepare to get underway, sir. That's automatic."
"But why are we at DEFCON 3 here?"
"Sir, they haven't told us that."
"Fabulous."
Painter pulled the sweater over his head and yelled for coffee.
"Roosevelt on line 2, sir,"
the intercom called. Painter punched the button and put the phone on speaker.
"This is Sinkland."
"Richards here, sir."
"What's going on?"
"Sir, we're 15 minutes into a DEFCON 2 alert here. We had a flight of MiG-29s inbound, and I ordered them splashed."
"Why?"
"They appeared to be armed, sir, and we copied a radio transmission about the explosion."
Painter went instantly cold.
"What explosion?"
"Sir, BBC reports a nuclear detonation in Denver. The local TV station that originated the report, they say, is now off the air."
"With that kind of information, I took the shot. I'm senior officer present. It's my battle group here."
"Sir, unless you have some more questions, I have things to do here."
Painter knew he had to get out of the man's way.
"Use your head, Ernie. Use your goddamn head."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Out."
The line went dead.
"Nuclear explosion?" Fleet Intelligence asked.
Painter had a hotline to the National Military Command Center. He activated it.
"This is Sinkland."
"Captain Roselli, sir."
Have we had a nuclear explosion?
That's affirmative, sir. In the Denver area, NORAD estimates yield in the low hundreds and high casualties. That's all we know. We haven't got the word out to everyone yet.
Well, here's something else for you to know.
Theodore Roosevelt just intercepted and splashed 4 MiG-29s inbound. Keep me posted. Unless otherwise directed, I'm putting everything to sea.
Bob Fowler was into his third cup of coffee already. He was cursing himself for having drunk those 4 strong German beers like he was Archie Bunker or something, and one of his fears was that the people here would notice the alcohol on his breath. Intellect told him that his thought processes might be somewhat affected by the alcohol intake, but he'd had the drinks over a period of hours, and natural processes plus the coffee either already had or soon would purge it from his system entirely. For the first time, he was grateful for the death of his wife, Marion. He'd been there at the bedside, had watched his beloved wife die. He knew what grief and tragedy were, and however dreadful the deaths of all those people in Denver might be, he told himself, he had to step back from it, had to set it aside, had to concentrate on preventing the death of anyone else. So far, Fowler told himself, things had gone well. He had moved quickly to cut off the spread of the news. A nationwide panic was something that he didn't need. His military services were at a higher level of alert that would either prevent or deter an additional attack for some indefinite period of time. Okay, he said on the conference line to NORAD and SAC. Let's summarize what has happened to this point. NORAD answered, Sir, we've had a single nuclear detonation in the 100 kiloton range. There has, as yet, been no report from the scene. Our forces are moving to a high state of alert. Satellite communications are down.
Why? Elizabeth Elliot asked in a voice more brittle than Fowler's. What could have done that?
We don't know. A nuclear detonation in space might, from EMP effects. That's electromagnetic pulse. When a nuclear device explodes at high altitude, most of its energy is released in the form of electromagnetic radiation. The Russians know more about the practical effects of such explosions than we do. They have more empirical data from their tests at Novaya Zemlya back in the 1960s. But we have no evidence of such an explosion, and we should have noticed it. Therefore, a nuclear attack on satellites is most unlikely. Next possibility is a massive blast of electromagnetic energy from a ground source. Now, the Russians have pumped a lot of money into microwave weapons research. They have a ship in the Eastern Pacific with lots of antennas aboard. It's the Yuri Gagarin. She's classed as a space event support ship, and she has 4 enormous high-gain antennas. That ship is currently 300 miles off the coast of Peru, well within sight of the injured satellites. Supposedly, the ship is supporting operations for the Mir space station. Aside from that, we're out of guesses. I have an officer talking with Hughes Aerospace right now to see what their thinking is. Okay, we're still trying to get ATC tapes from Stapleton to see if an aircraft might have delivered the bomb, and we are awaiting word from rescue and other teams dispatched to the site of the explosion. That's all I have. We have 2 wings fully in the air and more coming online as we speak, Sink Sack said next. All my missile wings are alerted. My Vice Sink is in the air in Looking Glass Auxiliary West, and another kneecap is about to take off for where you are, sir.
Anything happening in the Soviet Union?
Their air defense people are increasing their alert level, as we have already discussed, General Borstein replied. We're getting other radio activity, but nothing we can classify yet. There is no indication of an attack on the United States.
Okay. The president let out a breath. Things were bad, but not out of control. All he had to do was get things settled down, and then he could go forward.
I'm going to open the direct line to Moscow.
Very well, sir, NORAD replied. A Navy chief yeoman was 2 seats away from President Fowler. His computer terminal was already lit up.
You want to slide down here, Mr. President? The chief said. I can't cross-deck my display to your screen.
Fowler crab-walked his swivel chair the 8 feet to the chief's place.
Sir, the way this works is, I type in what you say here, and it's relayed directly through the NMCC computers in the Pentagon. All they do is encipher it. But when the Russians reply, it arrives in the hotline room in Russian, is translated there, and then sent here from the Pentagon. There's a backup at Fort Ritchie in case something goes wrong in D.C. We have landline and two separate satellite links. Sir, I can type about as fast as you can speak. The chief yeoman's name tag read Orancha, and Fowler couldn't decide what his ancestry was. He was a good 20 pounds overweight, but he sounded relaxed and competent. Fowler would settle for that. Chief Orancha also had a pack of cigarettes sitting next to his keyboard. The president stole one, ignoring the no-smoking signs that hung on every wall. Orancha lit it with a Zippo. All ready, sir. Chief Pablo Orancha looked sideways at his commander-in-chief. His gaze didn't betray the fact that he'd been born in Pueblo, Colorado, and still had family there. The president would settle things down. That was his job. Orancha's job, he reasoned, was to do his best to help the man. Orancha had served his country in 2 wars and many other crises, mainly as an admiral's yeoman on carriers. And now he turned off his feelings, as he had trained himself to do. Dear President Narmanov. Captain Roselli watched the first 4-reel transmission of the hotline since his arrival in Washington. The message was put up on the IBM PC-AT and encrypted. Then the computer operator hit the return button to transmit it. He really should be back at his desk, Jim thought, but what went through here might be vital to what he was doing. As you have probably been told, there has been a major explosion in the central part of my country. I have been told that it was a nuclear explosion and that the loss of life is severe. President Narmanov read, with his advisors at his side. About what one would expect, Narmanov said. Send our reply. Jesus, that was fast, the army colonel on duty remarked and began his translation. A marine sergeant typed the English version, which was automatically linked to Camp David, Fort Ritchie, and the State Department. The computers printed out hard copy that was sent almost as fast to SAC, NORAD, and the intelligence agencies via facsimile printer. Authenticator, timetable, timetable, timetable. Reply from Moscow. President Fowler, we have noted the event. Please accept our deepest sympathy and that of the Soviet people. How is such an accident possible? Accident? Fowler asked. That was awfully fast, Robert, Elliot observed at once. Too damned fast. His English isn't very good. The message had to be translated, and you take time to read things like this. Their reply must have been canned, made up in advance. What does that mean? Liz asked, almost talking to herself, as Fowler formulated his next message. What's going on here? Who is doing this, and why? President Narmanov, I regret to inform you that this was not an accident. There is no American nuclear device within 100 miles, nor were any U.S. weapons in transit in the area. This was a deliberate act by unknown forces. Well, that's no surprise, Narmanov said. He congratulated himself for correctly predicting the first message from America. Send the next reply, he told the communicator, to his advisors. Fowler is an arrogant man, with the weaknesses of arrogance, but he is no fool. He will be very emotional about this. We must settle him down, calm him. If he can keep control of himself, his intelligence will allow him to maintain control of the matter. My president, said Golovko, who had just arrived in the command center, I think this is a mistake. What do you mean? Narmanov asked in some surprise. It is a mistake to tailor your words to what you think of the man, his character, and his mental state. People change under stress. The man at the other end of that telephone line may not be the same man whom you met in Rome. The Soviet president dismissed that idea. Nonsense. People like that never change. We have enough of them here. I've been dealing with people like Fowler all my life. President Fowler, if this is in fact a deliberate act, then it is a crime wholly without precedent in human history.
What madmen would do such a thing, and to what purpose? Such action might all too easily lead to global catastrophe. You must believe that the Soviet Union had nothing to do with this infamous act.
Too fast, Robert, Elliot said. You must believe? What is this guy trying to say?
Elizabeth, you're reading too much into this, Fowler replied.
These responses are canned, Robert. Canned. He's answering too fast. He had them prepared in advance. That means something.
Like what?
Like we were supposed to be at the game, Robert. It looks to me like these were tailored for somebody else, like Durling. What if the bomb was supposed to get you too, along with Brent and Dennis?
I have to set that aside. I told you that, Fowler said angrily. He paused and took a deep breath. He could not allow himself to get angry. He had to stay calm.
Look, Elizabeth, you can't set that aside. You have to consider that possibility, because if it was planned, that tells us something about what is going on.
Dr. Elliot is right, NORAD said over the open phone line. Mr. President, you are entirely correct to distance yourself from this event in an emotional sense, but you have to consider all possible aspects of the operational concept that may be at work here.
I am compelled to agree with that, Sinksack added.
So what do I do? Fowler asked.
Sir, NORAD said, I don't like this you-must-believe stuff either. It might be a good idea to let him know that we're ready to defend ourselves.
Yeah, General Fremont agreed. He knows that anyway, if his people are doing their job right. But what if he takes our alert level as a threat?
They won't, sir, NORAD assured him. It's just how anybody would do business in a case like this. Their senior military leadership is very professional.
Dr. Elliot stirred at that remark, Fowler noted.
Okay. I'll tell him we've alerted our forces, but that we don't have any evil intentions. President Narmanov, we have no reason to suspect Soviet involvement in this incident. However, we must act prudently. We have been the victim of a vicious attack and must take action to protect ourselves against another. Accordingly, I have placed our armed forces on a precautionary alert. This is also necessary for the maintenance of public order and to assist in rescue operations. You have my personal assurance that we will take no offensive action without just cause.
That's reassuring, Narmanov said dryly. Nice of him to let us know about the alert.
We know, Golovkov said, and he must know that we already know.
He does not know that we know the extent of his alert, the defense minister said. He cannot know that we are reading their codes. The alert level of their forces is more than precautionary. The American strategic forces have not been at this readiness status since 1962.
Really? Narmanov asked.
General, that is not technically true, Golovko said urgently. Their ordinary level of readiness is very high for American strategic forces, even when their military posture is Defense Condition 5. The change to which you refer is inconsequential.
Is this true? Narmanov asked. The defense minister shrugged.
It depends on how you look at it. Their land-based rocket force is always at a higher level of alert than ours because of the lower maintenance requirements of their rockets. The same is true of their submarines, which spend far more time at sea than ours do. The technical difference may be small, but the psychological difference is not. The increased level of alert tells their people that something horrible is underway. I think that is significant.
I do not, Golovko shot back.
Marvelous, Narmanov thought. Two of my most important advisors cannot agree on something this important.
We need to reply, the foreign minister said.
President Fowler, we have noted your increased alert status. Since most of your weapons are in fact pointed at the Soviet Union, we must also take precautions. I suggest that it is vital that neither of our two countries take any action that might seem provocative.
That's the first time he didn't have it canned, Elliot said. First he says I didn't do it. Now he says we better not provoke him. What's he really thinking?
Ryan looked over the faxes of all 6 messages. He handed them to Goodley. Tell me what you think.
Pure vanilla.
Looks like everyone is playing a very cautious game, and that's what they should be doing. We alert our forces as a precaution, and they do the same. Fowler said that we have no reason to think they did it. That's good. Narmanov says both sides should play it cool on provoking the other side. That's good, too.
So far, so good, Ben Goodley thought.
I agree, the senior duty officer said. That makes it unanimous, Jack said. Thank God, Bob. I didn't know you had it in you.
Roselli walked back to his desk. Okay. Things appeared to be more or less under control.
Where the hell have you been? Rocky Barnes asked.
Hotline room. Things appear to be fairly cool.
Not anymore, Jim.
General Paul Wilkes was almost there. It had taken nearly 20 minutes to get from his house onto I-295 and from there to I-395, a total distance of less than 5 miles. Snowplows had barely touched this road, and now it was cold enough that what had been salted was freezing to ice anyway. Worst of all, those few DC drivers who were venturing out were showing their customary driving skill. Even those with 4-wheel drives were acting as though the additional traction made them immune to the laws of physics. Wilkes had just passed over South Capitol Street and was now heading downhill toward the Main Avenue exit. To his left, some maniac in a Toyota was passing him, and then came right to head for the exit into downtown D.C. The Toyota skidded sideways on a patch of ice that front-wheel drive didn't master. There was no chance to avoid it. Wilkes broadsided the car at about 15 miles per hour. "The hell with it," he said aloud. He didn't have time for this. The general backed up a few feet and started to maneuver around before the driver even got out. He didn't check his mirror. As he changed lanes, he was rear-ended by a tractor-trailer doing about 25. It was enough to drive the general's car over the concrete divider and into the face of another car. Wilkes was killed instantly.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
The Sum of All Fears by Tom Clancy.
Chapter 39. Echoes. Elizabeth Elliot stared blankly at the far wall as she sipped her coffee. It was the only thing that made sense. All the warnings they'd had and ignored. It all fit. The Soviet military was making a power play, and targeting Bob Fowler had to be part of it. We should have been there, she thought. He wanted to go to the game, and everyone expected him to, because Dennis Bunker owned one of the teams. I would have been there, too. I could be dead now. If they wanted to kill Bob, then they also wanted to kill me. President Narmanov. I am gratified that we agree on the necessity for caution and reason. I must now confer with my advisors so that we may ascertain the cause of this horrible event and also to begin rescue operations. I will keep you informed. The reply that came back was almost immediate. President Fowler, we will stand by. That's simple enough, the president said, looking at the screen.
Think so? Elliot asked.
What do you mean?
Robert, we've had a nuclear explosion at a location that you were supposed to be at. That's number one. Number two, we've had reports of missing Soviet nuclear weapons. Number three, how do we really know that it's Narmanov at the other end of this computer modem? Liz asked.
What? Our best intelligence suggests the possibility of a coup d'etat in Russia, doesn't it?
But we're acting now as though such intelligence did not exist, even though we've had what very easily could be a tactical nuclear weapon. Exactly what we think is missing explode over here. We are not considering all of the potential dimensions here. Dr. Elliot turned to the speakerphone. General Borstein, how hard is it to get a nuclear device into the United States?
With our border controls, it's child's play, NORAD replied.
What are you saying, Dr. Elliot? I'm saying that we've had hard intel for some time now that Narmanov is in political trouble, that his military is acting up, and that there's a nuclear dimension. Okay. What if they stage a coup? A Sunday evening, Monday morning, is good timing, because everyone's asleep. We always assumed that the nuclear element was for domestic blackmail. But what if the operation was more clever than that? What if they figured they could decapitate our government in order to prevent our interference with their coup? Okay, the bomb goes off, and Derling is on kneecap, just like he is right now, and they're talking to him. They can predict what we're going to think, and they pre-plan their statements over the hotline. We go on automatic alert, and so do they. You see? We can't interfere with the coup in any way.
Mr. President, before you evaluate that possibility, I think you need some outside advice from the intelligence community, Sinksack said. Another phone lit up. The yeoman got it.
For you, Mr. President, NMCC.
Who is this? Fowler asked.
Sir, this is Captain Jim Roselli at the National Military Command Center. We have two reports of contact between U.S. and Soviet forces. USS Theodore Roosevelt reports that they have splashed, that means shot down, sir, a flight of four inbound Russian MiG-29 aircraft.
What? Why?
Sir, under the rules of engagement, the captain of a ship has the right to take defense action to protect his command.
Theodore Roosevelt is now at DEFCON 2, and as the alert level changes, you get more latitude in what you can do and when you can take action.
Sir, the second is as follows. There is an unconfirmed report of shots being exchanged between Russian and American tanks in Berlin. Sakyur says the radio message stopped. I mean, it was cut off, sir. Before that, a U.S. Army captain reported that Soviet tanks were attacking the Berlin Brigade at its base in southern Berlin, and that a tank battalion of ours was just about wiped out, sir. They were attacked in their lager by Soviet forces stationed just across from them. Those two things, the reports, I mean, were almost simultaneous. The reported times were just 2 minutes apart, Mr. President. We're trying to reestablish contact with Berlin right now, going through Sakyur at Mons, Belgium.
Christ, Fowler observed.
Elizabeth, does this fit into your scenario?
It could show that they're not kidding, that they are serious about not being interfered with.
Most of the American forces had escaped out of the lager. The senior officer on the scene had decided on the spot to turn and run for cover in the woods and residential streets around the brigade base. He was a lieutenant colonel, the brigade executive officer. The colonel commanding the brigade was nowhere to be found, and the XO was now considering his options. The brigade had two mechanized infantry battalions and one of tanks. From the last, only 9 of 52 M1A1s had gotten away. He could see the glow from the rest of them, still burning in their lager. A DEFCON 3 alert out of nowhere, and then minutes later, this. Over 40 tanks and 100 men lost, shot down without warning. Well, he'd see about that. The Berlin Brigade had been in place since long before his birth, and scattered throughout its encampment were defensive positions. The colonel dispatched his remaining tanks and ordered his Bradley fighting vehicles to volley fire their TOW-2 missiles. The Russian tanks had overrun the tank lager and stopped. They had no further orders. Battalion commanders were not yet in control of their formations, left behind by the mad dash of the T-80s across the line, and the regimental commander was nowhere to be found. Without orders, the tank companies stopped, sitting still, looking for targets. The regimental executive officer was also missing,
and when the senior battalion commander realized this, his tank dashed off to the headquarters vehicle, since he was the next senior officer in the regiment. It was amazing, he thought. First the readiness drill, next the flash alert from Moscow, and then the Americans had started shooting. He hadn't a clue what was going on. Even the barracks and administrative buildings were still lit up, he realized. Someone would have to get those lights off. His T-80 was backlit, as though on a target range.
Command tank, 2 o'clock, skylined, moving left to right, a sergeant told a corporal.
Identified, the gunner replied over the intercom.
Fire!
On the way. The corporal squeezed his trigger. The seal cap blew off the missile tube, and the tow tube blasted out, trailing behind a thin control wire. The target was about 2,500 meters away. The gunner kept his crosshairs on target, guiding the anti-tank missile to its target. It took 8 seconds, and the gunner had the satisfaction of seeing detonation right in the center of the turret.
Target, the Bradley commander said, indicating a direct hit. Cease fire. Now let's find another one of these fuckers. 10 o'clock, tank, coming around the PX.
The turret came left.
Identified.
Okay, what does CIA make of this? Fowler asked.
Sir, again all we have is scattered and unconnected information, Ryan replied.
Roosevelt has a Soviet carrier battle group a few hundred miles behind them, and they carry MiG-29s, Admiral Painter said.
They're even closer to Libya, and our friend the Colonel has 100 of the same aircraft.
Flying over water at midnight? Painter asked.
When's the last time you heard of the Libyans doing that? And 20-some miles from one of our battle groups.
What about Berlin? Liz Elliott asked.
We don't know.
Ryan stopped and took a deep breath.
Remember that we just don't know much. Ryan? What if Spinnaker was right? Elliott asked.
What do you mean?
What if there is a military coup going on right now over there, and they set a bomb off over here to keep us from interfering, to decapitate us?
That's totally crazy, Jack answered.
Risk a war? Why do it? What would we do if there were a coup? Attack at once?
Their military might expect us to, Elliot pointed out.
Disagree. I think Spinnaker might have been lying to us from the beginning on this issue.
Are you making this up? Fowler asked. It was coming home to the president now that he might actually have been the real target of the bomb, that Elizabeth's theoretical model for the Russian plan was the only thing that made sense.
No, sir, Ryan snapped back indignantly. I'm the hawk here, remember? The Russian military is too smart to pull something like this. It's too big a gamble.
Then explain the attacks on our forces, Elliot said.
We don't know for sure that there have been attacks on our forces.
So now you think our people are lying? Fowler asked.
Mr. President, you are not thinking this through. Okay, let's assume that there is an ongoing coup in the Soviet Union. I don't accept that hypothesis, but let's assume it, okay? The purpose, you say, for exploding the bomb over here is to keep us from interfering.
Fine.
Then why attack our military forces if they want us to sit on our hands?
To show that they're serious, Elliot fired back.
That's crazy. It's tantamount to telling us they did explode the bomb here. Do you think they would expect us not to respond to a nuclear attack? Ryan demanded, then answered his own question. It does not make sense.
Then give me something that does, Fowler said.
Mr. President, we are in the very earliest stages of a crisis. The information we have coming in now is scattered and confused. Until we know more, trying to put a spin on it is dangerous.
Fowler's face bore down on the speakerphone.
Your job is to tell me what's going on, not to give me lessons in crisis management. When you have something I can use, get back to me.
What in the hell are they thinking? Ryan asked. Is there something I don't know here? Goodley asked. The young academic looked as alarmed as Ryan felt.
Why should you be any different from the rest of us? Jack snapped back and regretted it.
Welcome to crisis management. Nobody knows crap, and you're expected to make good decisions anyway. Except it's not possible. It just isn't. The thing with the carrier scares me, the S&T man observed. Wrong. If we only splashed 4 aircraft, it's only a handful of people, Ryan pointed out. Land combat is something else. If we really have a battle going on in Berlin, that's the scary one. Almost as bad as an attack on some of our strategic assets. Let's see if we can get hold of Sakyur. The 9 surviving M1A1 tanks were racing north along a Berlin avenue, along with a platoon of Bradley fighting vehicles. Streetlights were on, heads sticking out windows, and it was instantly apparent to the few onlookers that whatever was happening wasn't a drill. All the tanks had the speed governors removed from their engines, and they could all have been arrested in America for violating the national interstate highway limit. 1 mile north of their camp, they turned east. Leading the formation was a senior NCO who knew Berlin well. This was his 3rd tour in the once-divided city. Well enough that he had a perfect spot in mind, if the Russians hadn't got there first. There was a construction site. A memorial to the wall and its victims was going up after a long competition. It overlooked the Russian and American compounds which were soon to be vacated, and bulldozers had pushed up a high berm of dirt for the sculpture that would sit atop it. But it wasn't there yet, just a thick dirt ramp. The Soviet tanks were milling about on their objective, probably waiting for their infantry to show up or something. They were taking toe hits from the Bradleys and returning fire into the woods. Christ, they're gonna kill those Bradley guys, the unit commander, a captain whose tank was the last survivor of his company, said. Okay, find your spots. That took another minute. Then the tanks were hull down, just their guns and the tops of turrets showing. Straight down the line. Commence firing. Fire at will. All 9 tanks fired at once. The range was just over 2,000 meters, and now the element of surprise was with someone else. 5 Russian tanks died with the first volley, and 6 more in the second, as the Abrams tanks went into rapid fire. In the trees with the Bradleys, the Brigade XO watched the north end of the Russian line crumple. That was the only word for it, he thought. The tank crews were all combat vets, and now they had the edge. The northernmost Russian battalion tried to reorient itself, but one of his Bradleys had evidently scored on its commander, and there was confusion there. Why the Russians hadn't pressed home the attack was one question that floated about the rear of his brain, but that was something to save for the after-action report. Right now he saw that they had screwed up, and that was a good thing for him and his men. Sir, I've got 7th Army. The sergeant handed him a microphone. What's happening over there?
General, this is Lieutenant Colonel Ed Long. We just got our ass attacked by the regiment across town from us. No warning at all. They just came into our caserne like Jeb Stuart. We've got them stopped, but I've lost most of my tanks. We need some help here.
Losses?
Sir, I've lost over 40 tanks, 8 Bradleys, and at least 200 men.
Opposition?
1 regiment of tanks. Nothing else yet, but they have lots of friends, sir. I could sure use some myself. I'll see what I can do.
General Kuropatkin checked his status board. Every radar system that was not down for repair was now operating. Satellite information told him that 2 SAC bases were empty. That meant their aircraft were now airborne and flying toward the Soviet Union along with KC-135 tankers. Their missile fields would also be at full alert. His Eagle satellites would give launch warning, announcing that his country had 30 minutes left to live. 30 minutes, the general thought. 30 minutes and the reason of the American president were all that stood between life and death for his country.
Air activity picking up over Germany, a colonel said. We show some American fighters coming out from Ramstein and Bitburg heading east. Total of 8 aircraft.
What do we have on the American stealth fighters?
There is a squadron, 18 of them, at Ramstein. Supposedly the Americans are demonstrating them for possible sale to their NATO allies.
They could all be in the air right now, Kuropatkin noted, carrying nuclear weapons for that matter.
Correct.
They can easily carry two B-61-type weapons each. With high-altitude crews, they could be over Moscow before we knew it. And with their bomb sights, they could lay their weapons exactly on any target they wish. 2.5 hours from the time they lift off. My God. In the weapon's earth penetration mode, it could be placed close enough to eliminate the